And now our first segment with local attorney Kathy Manley. Kathy appeared in the first edition of the Hudson Mohawk magazine, something we'll note for all time. And she was talking about the case of Yusin Aref and Mohammed Hussein, two local Muslims who were sentenced to 15 years in prison due to their involvement in a dubious sting operation after 9/11, involving a loan for a pizza store that was alleged to instead to be financed in terrorist activities. We have asked Kathy back to talk about the issue of parole.
So what are some of the biggest concerns around parole today?
Well, first, thanks for having me, and I'm glad to be back. So parole in New York State and in other states, it's a big part of the problem with mass incarceration is that when people get to their finish the minimum term of their sentence, say if they're sentenced to 15 to life or 20 to life, you would expect that if they've done really well in prison, that when they get to that minimum term, they should be released. That's the expectation when a judge sentences somebody to something to life, that if you get to that something and you've done well, you should be released. But back in the 1990s, former Governor Pataki decided that he did not want people being released if they were convicted of murder, which most of these cases are murder cases. That's when you get usually that kind of a sentence. But these people have been locked up for, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40 years. And many of them have spotless records, are pose absolutely no danger to the public, and they were not being released, and they're still, for the most part, not being released. And I got involved in this. I represented a man named John McKenzie, who was basically a poster boy for parole release. He had been convicted of this burglary that went bad, that a police officer died. He shot this police officer, and back in 1975, John totally reformed. He didn't even have much criminal history before that. He did every possible program. He got 3 college degrees in prison. He started a victim awareness program in Greenhaven Prison, where he worked with groups like Mothers of Murdered Children, who strongly supported him because he was helping to raise awareness for their issues and teach people how to come to a place of remorse for their victim. And he really got it. And he got denied parole 10 times, over and over and over. And when I was representing him, he actually won a new hearing. A new parole hearing, which is all that a judge can do on a parole appeal, is they can't let you out. They can only say that you get a new hearing. You go back to the parole board. So he went back to the parole board for his new hearing, and they denied him again, just based on what happened on that day in 1975, and despite everything that's happened since then. And then I filed a motion to hold the parole board in contempt. And the judge granted it and said, yeah, the parole board is in contempt because I told them the way the law is in this court, this second department appellate division, you cannot deny release based only on the offense back in this case, 1975. You can't do that. You have to point to something else. And there was absolutely nothing else they could point to. So she held them in contempt, Judge Rosa in Dutchess County. And they were going to be charged $500 a day. But the attorney general's office appealed, and this was going to be a drawn out appeal to the second department, appellate division, second department. And John, my client, he just couldn't wait for this anymore. He'd been denied 10 times. He turned 70. He was in Fishkill Correctional Facility, which was worse than where he had been previously. He was being woken up every night for the count for no reason, made to stand up, and he was just being treated really badly, and he could not take it anymore. And he also knew that his case had already been written about in the New York Times. He knew that kind of the spotlight was on him, and he ended up killing himself last August, 2016, August 4th, right around there, 2016. And it was really devastating because I thought we were winning in court. We got them held in contempt. We just wait another year. You've been locked up 42 years already. Well, he couldn't wait another year. So that was really sad and tragic. But as a result of John's death, it really spurred on this movement for parole reform that was already going on. A lot of people were starting to come together around this issue in New York and put a lot of pressure on the parole board to actually do what they're supposed to do, let people out when they've done well. After John's death, there was a lot of pressure put on Governor Cuomo to appoint new parole commissioners who were not the ones that Pataki had appointed that were never going to let people out, because a lot of these Pataki appointees had been reappointed. So there was enough pressure put on Governor Cuomo where he did not reappoint some of the worst commissioners, and he did reappoint, he did appoint five or six new ones who should be better. They've been better so far. And they also put through new parole regulations directly as a result of John's death, where they have to give more detailed reasons before denying release. They can't just say, oh, we think, you know, your release would deprecate the seriousness of the crime, of the offense. And they have to give more reasons than that. And so...
Is New York exceptional on this, or are other states as bad?
There's other states that are as bad. The ACLU did a report on a bunch of different states, and they chose New York as one of the bad states. But there's other bad states, too, that are very similar to New York. So it's a nationwide problem. And it's like resentencing people, you know. They get sentenced to 15 to life. They, you know... The judge even tells them a lot of times, well, if you do well, when you get to that 15 years, they should let you out. Well, that's not what happens, you know. So it's starting to change in New York. I don't know about in other states.
So the denial of parole in John's case was predominantly based on the Pataki precedent?
Yeah, it was based only on that, what happened on that day in 1975. There was absolutely nothing else they could point to. And it was this Pataki. I mean, there was an unspoken idea that you're never going to let these people out, that if somebody is convicted of murder, especially if the victim is a police officer, that was a big factor, too, that they should never get out. That was the basically policy under Pataki. They couldn't say that, but that was it. And now it's barely, there's some chinks in it. It's starting to change.
So you talked about a few changes they've made, particularly, you know, appointing, you know, five or six people. Are there other changes that are still needed?
Well, like the new regulations, that's one step in the right direction. But one of the biggest things is that more and more judges are starting to say no and give people new hearings. Also hold them in contempt. Like, we got them held in contempt, and that decision was upheld even after John's death, even though, you know, it was kind of mooted because he's no longer with us. But there have been some other cases since then where the parole board's been held in contempt. And that's, you know, that's a pretty strong tool to get them to try to follow the law, because the law says you can't deny people based only on the seriousness of the offense, and that's what they've been doing. So, you know, those cases are on appeal up at the Second Department. We'll see what happens with those. So it's the courts, the new commissioners, the new regs, just the people that are really paying attention to this and, you know, trying to force change within that system.
What happens to people when they do come out of the system, especially if they've been in there 25, 35 years? Things like computers and iPhones and much of the world has changed.
Yeah, it's well, I have one client who just got out after 30 years and he's doing great. But I mean, it's very challenging, I'm sure. But, you know, he called me up and he said, I was just in a Salvation Army shelter for a couple of days. It was awesome. I'm like, wow, you got a good attitude. But, you know, everything's in a way is awesome, but it's also really challenging because the world is a different place. You have to figure out all these things. You have this stigma by having been in prison so long. It's hard to find jobs, so, you know, it's tough. But this one guy, Eddie, is doing great. And by the way, he got granted parole release on the anniversary of John's death. And I wrote to his family and said, this is a result of John. John did this for you, you know.
That's a pretty incredible thing. So it feels like there was some meaning. So what are some of the biggest changes that people report when they're actually out in the world? Is it the, obviously with the Salvation Army shelter comment, the whole idea of just what it would have been back, 25 years ago as compared to now? There are obviously upgrades, but it's also a more complex world. So what are some of the specific comments that people have about the complexity?
I haven't talked to people all that much since they've gotten out. But, one guy was saying, he's like, why are all these people talking to themselves on the street? Because they're using their cell phones and he didn't see the cell phones. And it's just a lot of weird things. But, I just want to say one other thing, which is that the parole board always says, there's... you don't have a good chance of avoiding future crimes. And that's why we're not letting you out. There's a high probability that you'll commit future crimes based on no evidence at all. So what I started doing is every time somebody did get out, I would look up and see if they were locked up again. And in none of the cases, and none of these murder cases, none of them, and I had like 50 of them in my motions, none of them were ever locked up again. So that's 100%. The parole board's wrong because these are people that were denied and then the court, gave them a new hearing. So the recidivism rate for these people is almost zero.
What about personal factors? Do parole boards ever take into account family, the fact that this person is a parent? What are the personal considerations that might sway ruling on parole?
I mean, they don't look at that much. They say they look at if you have good connections with your family, and that's a positive factor, but they really put very little weight on that. They just pretty much look at the offense way back in the 70s or 80s, whenever it was, and they don't want to look at a lot else. Certainly it is true that people do better when they have, good family connections and good connections on the outside and support for their reentry. And I hope the parole board will look at that more in the future.
So we're about to transition to our next guest. But so if people are interested in this issue, how do they find out more information? And can they also get active in supporting, parole?
Yeah. So Parole Justice New York, you could look Parole Justice New York, you could look up. That's a group that's been active on this. It's a statewide coalition. And also locally here in the Capital Region, there's Capital Area Against Mass Incarceration is also active around parole reform as well as a lot of other issues.
Okay. Well, Kathy Manley, we want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.